Welcome to the class on plain speaking. I saw the description had some questions, such as, is it important to be teaching concise and biblical speaking and things like that? I think they go without even mentioning. I feel it's very important to teach public speaking. History tells us of a common little boy, Demosthenes, that was born in Athens in 384 B.C. He's born more handicapped than most of us. Age of seven, his parents died. He was orphaned at seven. Unhandicapped in this way, his dad left him with $11 million. And history isn't quite sure why he studied rhetoric, why he studied public speaking, but some suggest because he was of delicate physique. And so he thought, if I can talk, I'll make up for what I lack in brawn. Others, and I would decide that he studied it because he wanted to take his legal guardians to court because he believed they'd mismanaged that $11 million his dad left him. But his other problem was he had a speech impediment, like a serious speech impediment, where he stuttered, he couldn't get the words out right, but he was determined to master this thing of public speaking. So history tells us that he spoke with pebbles in his mouth. He stuck pebbles in his mouth so he would learn to articulate clearly so people could hear him. He would go out and stand on the shore and shout out into the waves to work on projection and how well his voice would carry. He would run up and down the hills by the coast to build that stamina so that he could deliver the speech that he wanted to. And when he came of age, he demanded an account. In his own words, he said the stewards had squandered everything, his own words, except the house and 14 slaves and 30 silver minae, which is $390,000. So from the $11 million, he said he only has $390,000. And he gave five speeches. They ruled in his favor and he received $7.8 million. He went on to achieve fame as one of the greatest orators in Greece. And he wasn't born that way. He wasn't born that way at all. But he developed, he trained and became that way. The ability to speak well is something that's learned. It's not all innate. We aren't all born with it. So where are we going today and what are we talking about? I put a list of things on the board as four main things I want to make sure we cover at the beginning before we get into the nuts and bolts of what I believe a good public speech would be. First of all, we need to make sure we are speaking that is true. And I found quotes ascribed to Demosthenes. He says, "Nothing is easier than self-deceit, for what each man wishes, that he also believes to be true." So, first of all, if we're going to be effective, our speech should be that is true. Not what we decide is true, not what we think might be true, not what we wish were true, but what is true. Content needs to be truth. We also need to speak what communicates. We need to communicate with our audience, get into their minds, find a way to actually connect. That's where the work is done. If you can't connect, you've wasted your time. And it's very closely related to the speaking what leads. Demosthenes says, "All speech is vain and empty unless it be accompanied by action." I think sometimes we hear a speech that's just in Southern BC, I went to a little creation thing put on by Mike Riddle, and with a whole bunch of Pentecostals and all those people, you know. And it felt like any time it would come up on how terrible our society is and how evolutionist everything was, everyone had a whole lot to say. And I think you'll find that discussion in churches and in modern Christianity as a whole. If you bring up the subject of how terrible everything is, everyone has a whole lot to say. But it doesn't lead. It doesn't take us anywhere, do any good. So speak that leads. Make sure that there's action, positive action. And speaking what's remembered, that is the end of the goal. If we walk out the doors and don't remember a thing, it's not worth a whole lot. And as far as public speaking from Demosthenes, and what's remembered, a man who has received the benefit ought always to remember it. But he who has granted it ought to forget the fact at once. So there you go for the public speaker. So how do we go about a great speech? Beginning with preparation. The first point I want to make is to pray. Every speech, every assignment, whenever you come down to do your notes, ought to be a time on your knees. I feel like if you're going to, when I go to my desk to punch into my computer and start making notes, the very first thing I do is pray. And it's not to lift myself up, but everyone ought to be doing that. How can we enter into something that's going to communicate, that's going to lead, that's going to be true, without connecting to the source of all those things? Mm-hmm. So prayer is essential. And prayer the whole time through. Invest time. They say the good rule of thumb is to spend an hour for every minute you're going to speak up front. And maybe some of you are familiar with Merle Ruth. He's kind of a renowned speaker in conservative circles. And he does this with his sermons. He figures he puts 40 hours into every sermon he delivers for a 40-minute sermon. And one time there was people listening to his message, and they went home and they said, "Dad, I heard Merle say five times this morning." And the dad said, "Well, he just discovered he was supposed to preach when he got to church this morning. He had no time to prepare." That was the kind of someone who's effective and can communicate. We need to put that time in. Spend a minute for every hour if we can. The way I get around this for myself is these things brew in our minds. I don't feel like it needs to be an hour in front of a computer screen or a piece of paper, but that thing should weigh on us for 40 hours straight of just good, solid thought. I went and looked on my documents after I was ready to print the documents for the sessions this week, and I discovered that I spent right between 160 and 180 minutes on all the other talks I was supposed to give this week. And then this one was 370 or something like that. Still not just way up there, but if you can spend about an hour for every minute you want to be up front. Woodrow Wilson says, and some of this has been ascribed to Lincoln, and where I can find Woodrow Wilson was more saying the actual words. When someone asked him how much time it takes to prepare for a speech, he said, "It depends. If I'm to speak for 10 minutes, I need a week of preparation. If 15 minutes, 3 days. If half an hour, 2 days. If an hour, I'm ready now." So boil it down and boil it down and boil it down again. Invest time. Boiling down comes later. The third point about preparation is think about your audience. Think about who they are. Again, we want to communicate. So think about who they are. Are they students at a young level? Will they have any knowledge of the subject? What might be their perspective of what you're going to share? What could they be wrestling with? What might be their fears? So that you can speak into that. Why do you believe they should be listening to you? Think about your audience. And how can you connect with them? What is a true thread that you could make a little connection into their experience? That goes for any kind of communication. I feel like sometimes whenever we're faced with a problem or we're given an assignment, we first of all start thinking about the solution. This is what we can give as a solution. I think we ought to think primarily about how can I engage, first of all? How can I engage a discussion, engage thought, and then we can lead on to the solution. Think about your subject preparation. Try to see your subject from a different vantage point. There's the Dead Poets Society is a little movie that's kind of famous in some ways and among some people. And in that, the teacher teaches his students to look at things from a different perspective, a beautiful illustration of the teacher. And one thing they do is they stand on their desk. So he has everyone stand on their desk and do this or that, because it teaches you to look at something from a different perspective. I think it's valuable to try to get outside of who you are and look at your subject from a different perspective, so that will give you that vantage point, that broadness from which to approach and share. Think about your subject and your notes as you're preparing, and try to see if there's intrinsic value in what you have to share. Or isn't the value of what you have to share, is that dependent on your salesman technique, how well you're going to be able to do with it? Actually have something to share. And then thinking about your subject, decide, is it true? Is it true? Is this statement I'm making true? I feel like I probably make way too many sweeping statements, and I ought to come back and clarify them. I thought Uwe did well with that this morning. There was one or two things he said, this isn't quite always true, but generally this is how it is. It's a better way than those sweeping statements. Is it true what you're sharing? Invest more time. And invest yourself. Let the subject burn in you. Winston Churchill says, "Before he can inspire them with any emotion, he must be swayed by it himself. When he would arouse their indignation, his heart is filled with anger. Before he can move their tears, his own must flow. To convince them, he must himself first believe. Let it burn in you. Get a hold of it. And passion draws people like few other things. If a person is passionate about microbiology, because Jonah's here in the front, or something like that, it just draws you in. You want to listen to them because they care about the subject. Passion will cover a whole multitude of sins. Jesus spoke with authority, and it's what drew crowds to him. I think he was passionate about what he had to share. Boil it down, then, in your preparation. Try to boil it down. Try to boil it down. And we all know Abe Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. So after Edward Everett had spoken for 2 hours in a memorized speech, that sounds hard to beat, Abe Lincoln stood up and gave the Gettysburg Address. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. I'm not going to take the time to read the whole thing. You know, he says, we doubt whether the world will little note nor long remember here what we say, while it can never forget what they did here. And that's one of the best remembered speeches of the modern era. But it was boiled down and boiled down and boiled down. There's arguments about how many drafts he made. They said he was on the train sketching things out and rewriting them. I'm partly of the opinion maybe he was boiling that thing down even at that last moment, whenever he sat under 2 hours of the previous speaker. He had good time to make his thoughts count. Make your time count. Boil it down. The last thing in preparation, I feel like we need to understand the fire with which we play. A person who's going to speak publicly, who's going to have passion, who's going to do well, then becomes influential, very influential. And we need to understand that power, because there could be a smoking flax that we could quench. And there could be a smoldering wick that we could just puff on and light up. There's extreme power there. So understand the fire with which you play, and that ought to bring a soberness on us and an earnestness to do well with the public speaking. Moving into delivery, how to go about it, actually, part of this plays back, of course, into preparation. Start with a story. Try to start with the story of Demosthenes. And this comes, I remember one of the first times I heard this was Uwe Steinman, when he spoke about public speaking here, I'd say 5 years ago. It's one of the best things I've ever heard. And so I don't know why he isn't here instead. And if you listen, in all his classes, he always starts with a story. If Uwe ever goes up front and doesn't start with a story, you know he's off his medication or something is wrong. He will start with a story. Why? It draws people in. When we tell stories, people sit up and listen. Speaking is about communicating. You know you only have that little window when you start speaking up front to catch their attention, or the people are going to go to sleep and you can't wake them up. And this is why people stand up front to teach Sunday school, and they read the lesson focus, and they talk about a couple other things, about the history of this or that, and then they say, "Do you have any thoughts?" And nobody has a single thought, because nobody's been inspired yet. No one's woken up. But if the Sunday school teacher gets up front and he asks 3 or 4 leading questions, things that no one thought about, that aren't in the Sunday school lesson, and then he talks about a few things and he says, "Do you have any thoughts?" Thoughts pop up right and left. You've got a little window to grab their attention and to wake them up. Starting with the story is a great way to do that. Christ told stories time after time. We had this already in the General Assembly. A certain man had 2 sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Give me the portion of goods that falleth to me." Just draws them right in. I think the best illustration of this, of a story and the power of story in public speaking or addressing, this isn't public speaking, but the power of stories, there in the Old Testament where it says, "And the Lord sent Nathan unto David, and he said, there were 2 men in one city, the one rich and the other poor, the rich man exceeding many flocks and herds." You know how that story goes on? And David was just drawn right into that thing till he said, "That man ought to be slain," or judgment. And then Nathan was able to say, "But the man is you." That he drawn in David with the story. Stories are powerful. God spoke in stories. Imagine if the Bible were made up of Leviticus and just the law. But there's the stories. They illustrate. That's why that holds the interest and teaches, communicates to us. stories can also easily fit into the material you have to share. It's much more easy than we think it is. Jim Morrison, a couple years ago, spoke about this, maybe last year, about teaching your students to speak publicly. He says, have a story for every point you want to make. I really think maybe Uwe does this. I wasn't testing him out on it. But you can make a story up from almost anything. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of twist it at the end. And it can work. Or you can look at it from a different perspective. Don't tell the story if it's going to just distract. But you can find a story for every point you need to make. And stories are memorable. They're the things we'll remember after the class. Second point on delivery is be human. Again, that's why we tell stories. Stories humanize us. They make us real. We're not someone far away and distant. And the listeners... your listeners want to feel like they're cared for. This is under being human. They need to be convinced to trust their mind into your hand. This is talked about a lot in writing. When you write, you need to think about your audience because you want your audience to trust their mind into the author's hand as he writes. It's the same for public speaking. So you need to be human. You need to be a real person, someone they can trust. I feel like telling personal stories, it's a very good place here. And if you can tell a story that even embarrasses you a little bit, it's okay. It makes the people see you as a person. And it makes them make that connection with you. Backing up a little on being convinced to trust their minds into your hands by being human, the best illustration of this is Mark Antony. And again, we don't know if this is the speech Mark Antony gave. This is the speech Shakespeare wrote for Mark Antony. So maybe when you mix two of the best, it's two of the very good. It's hard to beat. I like this because if you get the setting for this, so Caesar has been killed. Brutus says, Brutus started a whole rebellion, essentially. And he says, Caesar's the bad guy. We need to get rid of him. So he's got everyone on his side and said, Caesar is too ambitious, we're going to kill him. Mark Antony was a friend of Caesar's. And he said, would you give me a chance to speak? And he talked to Brutus and he kind of pretended like he was on Brutus's side or he understood some faults of Caesar. And Brutus said, we'll give you a chance to speak. So Mark Antony has just a couple minutes or half an hour in which to turn the attitudes of all those listeners. So all these people sat under Brutus, they're just passionate with, it's a good thing to kill Caesar. Now Antony needs to come up and turn that thing on Brutus, if he can. And this is what he says, friends, Romans, countrymen, just connecting with them, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it were so, it were a grievous fault. And grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here, under leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man, so are they all honorable men, come I to speak at Caesar's funeral. He is my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. He hath brought many captives home to Rome. Whose ransoms did the general coffers fill? Did this in Caesar seem ambitious? Why then have the poor cried? When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. Ye all did see that on the leprechaun I thrice presented him, Caesar, the kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and sure, he's an honorable man. I speak not to disprove what Brutus spoke, but here I am to speak what I do know. You all did love him once, not without cause. What cause withholds you then to mourn for him? O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me, my heart is in the coffin here with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me. There was a dead silence then, I'm sure. And the people's hearts were changed. And you have Antony coming down and opening up the coffin. He says, let's take a look at this. And he points to the dagger wounds. And he says, I think that's where Brutus's went in. And that's where the other guy's dagger went in. And the people are crying. And they go out and they They hunt down Brutus in the streets. Very powerful way of changing them. But he started out as being human, as drawing them in, and then not avoiding the facts about Brutus for who he was, but pointing out and appealing to their, to where they had been, appealing to the people's fears and loves. So be human. Another part of delivery is speak clearly, slowly, and distinctly. Big fault of mine. So I tend to rush. And when you're in front and you're nervous, your mouth also dries out. Very practical problem. And then your lips and your teeth and your tongue just doesn't flow right. And you trip up. I really do. See him opening a water bottle. I keep a cup of tea. That's for the nerves. Care about what you're speaking about. We had this in preparation, but care about what you're speaking about. Study, 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 and let it get a hold of you. And then when you care about it, begin to lose yourself in your speech, if possible. It will help with the nervousness as well. But if you can lose yourself, become your speech. Become the subject you have to share. It will open you up for gesturing and hand gesturing, which can be very helpful. Sam Pickering wrote this. He's the teacher, a teacher that was... He writes this about a former... He says, a former student said that when my class studied Poe's poem, The Raven, I stood a boy on a chair and told him to flap his arms every time we came to the word nevermore. So this is a little bit about looking from a different perspective, too. I did not remember that class, but I was lively and young when I taught an MBA, and sounds like something I might have done. I remember standing on desks and in waste cans. One day I went outside and taught through the window. I did such things not so much to awaken students as to entertain myself. If I had fun, I suppose I thought the boys would have fun too and maybe even enjoy reading and writing. So lose yourself. And there are limits with this, of course. Never, ever lose your dignity. Lose yourself, but try not to lose your dignity. But do something a little different. It will wake people up. Do lose yourself. Be willing to cry or to weep if you have to. Be willing to rise, to move around, and be willing to whisper. Just lose yourself and enter into actually what is being shared. Gesture, get your hands up there. The perfect illustration of gesture is Patrick Henry's Liberty speech. Give me liberty or give me death. And you know we don't really know what he said in that speech because no one was allowed to go in and they had dirt banked up over the doors of the church in which it was. And it was some, I think, Anabaptist-ish Quaker. No, it's not Anabaptist per se, but some Quakerish fellow that actually wrote what we have of Patrick Henry's speech. But they said that he said, he was talking about the bonds of tyranny and the bonds he was bound with. And then he said, give me liberty or give me death. And he took a stagger and he sat right back in the bench behind him and just stopped. And the whole audience was shaken and moved, and they were ready for action. But Jester, go ahead and act out what you're speaking about. I have a few points under use the power of these things. Use the power of repetition. Repeat a point. But don't repeat a point. Repeat to build. I need to have a point and a repetition. You know those preachers that their thoughts go in circles and circles and circles and they repeat the same thing 3 or 4 times and at the end of the message, it could have been a 15-minute message or public speaker too. I don't want to just draw out the preachers. Repeat to build. Winston Churchill in 1940 spoke this. I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, this is during World War II when he's afraid of the fall of England. I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once again able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. Listen to the repeating in through here and how it builds. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament in the nation. The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag nor fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight on the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for one moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, will carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and liberation of the old. He's hoping the U.S. is going to join the war one of these days. Repetition. He repeats in there, but he's going somewhere with every repetition he makes, and we move forward in the speech. Winston Churchill is known as a very good orator. You can actually find clips to listen to him, and I'm not quite sure what made him so good, because he seems to kind of talk in a monotone like this from what I've listened to him. I'm seeing some confused looks and scaring me that I'm saying the wrong thing. But it seems very monotone when he would share. But he wrote. He was a writer, first of all. And he wrote his speeches out word for word. And he took baths twice a day. He would not miss his morning and evening bath. And he would sit there in the suds and give his speeches. He'd practice them to his tubs. Use the power of questions. Ask those questions. I think Mark Antony's speech said this. He said, was that ambitious of him to refuse the crown three times? Ask the questions. Use the power of questions that makes us think. Use the power of figures of speech. Figures of speech and questions are in this next point where Christ did. He said, what went ye out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken with the wind? What went ye out for to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft raiment are in king's houses. But what went ye out to see? A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. That those questions build and make us think. Use the power of stories. We've hit on that before. Use the power of quotes. Your work stands tall on the shoulders of others. If you can bring in some good quotes, some good things other people have said. Ken Blanchard, a little quote from him. None of us is as smart as all of us. Then move forward from your point to point logically if possible. Sometimes it's difficult to move logically from point to point, and it's just scattershot. But if possible, some speakers seem to swim around in a muddle more than others. And I think I'm for sure one of those. My thoughts can just kind of go here and there and be too scattered. Never, ever lose sight of where you want to come out at the end of the speech, or what you want to be accomplished by the speech. So keep that as your goal and keep working toward it. Conclusion, end only once. I know a very good bishop, and he says that it bothers him so much when he's preaching, when he can hear those Bibles zipping shut. Well, maybe craft your sermon so the Bibles don't zip shut until the thing's done. If you end it twice, the Bibles are going to be zipping shut. And you're going to, it's very annoying. So end only once. I'm not done yet. In case you're I want some questions from you all. And end with strength. Two examples that Winston Churchill has to say about ending with strength. He says, the climax of oratory is reached by a rapid succession of waves of sound and vivid pictures. The audience is delighted by the changing seasons, scenes presented to their imagination. Their ear is tickled by the rhythm of the language. The enthusiasm rises. A series of facts is brought forward, all pointing in a common direction. The end appears in view before it is reached. The crowd anticipates the conclusion, and the last words fall amid a thunder of assent. There's ending with power. And in one of his speeches where he did this, he says at the end of it, this is where some of his fellows were saying, it's time really that we ought to just surrender London. He says, if we don't surrender London in this war, it's going to be worse for us. But let's make terms. And a lot of his cabinet, the people around him, were deciding that surrender was the best thing. And so he was deeply grieved and spent a lot of time pouring himself into this. And this is how he ended his speech to his parliament. He said, I'm convinced that every one of you would rise up and tear me down from my place if I were for one moment to contemplate parley or surrender. If this Long Island story of ours is to end at last, let it only end when each of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. Kind of just brought the axe right down at the end. Everybody knew where he stood. Talk a little bit about the aftermath before we go into questions. Know that after you're finished and you walk away from the podium, you're going to feel very small and you're going to feel very embarrassed and you're going to think you made a mess of things. If you heard, I think it was Brother Jonathan yesterday in his 10-minute talk, he's always afraid that, he said, sometimes his teachers can be afraid that someone's going to expose us as being a fraud. That's how I always feel. And I told someone that after I got finished with one of the classes yesterday and started speaking with one of the students, started asking me questions, I always get nervous. They're going to expose me as a fraud. They're going to ask that wrong question. Know that you're going to have to deal with these feelings of embarrassment after you've been up front. Try also to be humble and gracious. I don't know what the best response to either correction or to compliments is. I feel like there ought to be just a sense of humility, and you can say, give God the glory, or you can just say thank you if someone expresses appreciation. My brother led singing in front of church for the first time. He was very nervous, and he finished up, and the school teacher for years, David Martin, he wrote the Handbook for Creative Teaching, so he does it about as good as it can be done. He met him afterwards, and he said, did you know that you beat a 3-4 pattern to a 4-4 song the whole way through? And I was like, yeah, he really did. And then he says, and also the pitch was off by about one tone. It's really good, though. It's really good. It's probably what my brother needed. And coming from him, he's his type of fella, he could do it. But how are you going to deal with that? When you hear that, I'm sure it wasn't just easy for him to say, well, thank you very much, I'm so encouraged. it's very difficult. So be ready for those people that will address something that was a little different than you expected. I had this recently where a fellow made myself clear when I was speaking, and then someone wanted to make sure I was right on this point after the thing was finished. Be humble and gracious. Another thing you can do with WFTI, or if your speeches are recorded, is listen to them again. I often listen to mine again. Not because I enjoy it. Our voices sound really bad on recordings. And there's all those things that should have been done differently. But if you can listen and evaluate and then record, record and then listen again, it will help you learn to slow down maybe. Help you learn to just see it's not that big of a deal. Listen if you can. Questions you have or points that are imperative that we've skipped, jumped over. This is not all conclusive. I wasn't sure where to start and what aspects to talk about.
Is it equally important for young ladies to learn public speaking as for young men?
Is it equally important for young ladies as young men to learn to speak in public? I think it is. The problem is, or is there any thoughts? Give the answer here. It's this engaged discussion, right?
I'd just like to say that recently I was in a counseling position with a young woman, and a lot of the points that you've made today have been very valuable. They feel they're very helpful points when you're just talking one on one with someone, as well as you're leading the Sunday school class.
So it's about communicating, whether it's in front of a crowd or just an individual. That's very good. I feel like they're going to be school teachers, perhaps. They can lead Sunday school discussions. I feel like they should. The unfortunate part is they don't get opportunities to practice. And I don't know of anyone that was able to deliver a great speech the first time he got behind a lectern. So there are women are just disadvantaged. There's no practicing ground.
I disagree with that. Even if they get married and they have a husband, husbands are pretty hard to convince. They need all the help they can get.
Yeah. So do take these things to heart. That's good.
And consultate the young lady who goes to the court to defend the position on why they don't want to be a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Just
so you might have to go before court and defend your position. There are, I'm sure, famous stories of good women orators. Do you know of any, Claudia? I'm sorry.
Queen Elizabeth before
you mentioned that one. I did not get it in my notes. Queen Elizabeth is a very young queen, as I remember the story, and her military is going out to face the French Armada. Which?
Spanish Armada.
Yeah. So they're going out to face the Spanish Armada, and this is a defining moment for England. And she's just this little queen. And this history tells us she walked down between them and just told them how she believed in them, how they were going to do well. And it was a very, very good, effective job. I feel like, yes, it's important for them to. The problem is they might not get to exercise it, unless on their husbands.
Abigail and Queen Esther both got opportunity to exercise.
Yeah. This is true.
Early.
This is true. And I don't think we can overemphasize the point that was brought here about understanding where you stand and truth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like any of the ladies, if they're ever called into question on anything, should be shy about saying, well, I believe this, and it's actually what they believe. They shouldn't have to say, you know, well, let me ask my dad or something like that. It ought to be there.
You mentioned Jim Morrison at one point in teaching at our school. He's very strong in geography and public speaking. And the young ladies, as well as the fellows, were required to do oral reports quarterly. And some of it ended up being oftener than that.
Mm-hmm.
They got right up there and were graded just like boys were and shared, and parents came in to listen.
That is,
there's opportunities to get a little exercise on that level.
That is so good. I've not seen Jim around here yet. I don't know if he will be here or not. But I really like what he has to.
Yeah.
He has some super programs in his classrooms with teaching his students to speak.
Even school teachers, children have very short attention spans.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Good. That's super good. So obviously, if you're here, you're quite possibly a teacher, and you're going to have to use stories. You're going to have to use connect to your students. Backing up a little bit to Jim, I think it's from him where he talked about teaching this. Maybe we should talk about teaching students to speak publicly. He sometimes has them do one thing at a time, where they'll come up front and then they go back and sit down at their desk. They're too nervous to talk. Mm-hmm. So well, then you just come up front, and I want you to turn around and do eye contact, and then go sit back down at your desk. And then the next time, maybe you can give your name and eye contact and sit down. You know, just slowly build them into it. It'll be effective sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Along with that, like when you do a program, the children, you want them to know it well enough that they can say it even if they're very nervous. Admire ministers. My dad memorized, you know, all the vows, and I kind of have a hard time with people that don't get out there and preach to your college or something.
Yep.
Memorize.
Yep. Exactly.
And even when you're nervous, you feel remembered.
Yes, that's very good. Memorize as much as you can. You'll get your 40 hours in, for one thing. But I know I've studied for probably the talks here before in my classroom in BC, and I'll be there over my desk studying away, and pretty soon I'll find myself in the back of the room walking back and forth. It's just, you need to do something and repeat that thing, memorize it, drill it in. You know, my dad, if he's ever studying anything, he's out milking the cows, and he says that's why Peter went fishing. He needed time to think and maybe to mull over everything that happened. Helps us sort out our thoughts. With the nervousness things, a few things. Mark Twain, I believe it is, he says that he memorized his speech and he was ready to give it, but he had his scroll, his notes wrapped up and stuck in the flagpole in case he forgot something. Mm-hmm. And he was there ready to fall back on them.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing you said there about breaking it down, when you're starting with students, you're trying to teach them to arrive at the right place. And it's overwhelming as a package. Mm-hmm. Right? And what you said, you know, how to walk up to the podium, how to stand, and these are kind of concrete things that are easy to remember, but give them a tremendous amount of confidence. Mm-hmm. I remember Uwe, that was like 5 years ago when he gave that talk, he said, you know, you walk up there and you square yourself up at the podium, you look down, and then you look up at your audience, and all these little things, they give you confidence. Mm-hmm. And it's breaking it down so that terrified young girl has things to do, mm-hmm. and that's half the program. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the speech is the other half.
Thank you. You're making me nervous. But it is true. And you know, there are big studies done on how choirs come on stage before they sing. I feel like we should throw this out because you're all going to do programs this year. You should. Make sure your students come on stage with energy. Mm-hmm. So if you're off stage, you come on stage with energy. They say, is it Concordia? One of those, they say that basically their cloaks are just flying out behind them. And they're famous for this. Like, when they come on stage, they're coming on with energy and determination. And it makes people sit up and say, this person has something to say. If they're shuffling up there, then you're not quite sure.
Just share an idea. This thing of nervousness is something that I still face in a huge way. And it's something that can be conquered. And it's like a lot of other things where it simply takes practice. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I've done with my students, last year I taught, every morning one of them was to get up and share a verse with the class. Just simply walk up to the podium. That was the first item of business on the day. They had to choose the verse, and I told them their only requirement was to make eye contact with us and smile. So day after day.
That is practice. So good. I like that on a whole lot of levels. So maybe have your class share a verse, one student every day. Make eye contact.
Is it a verse by memory, or they read it from their Bible?
They can read it.
Mm-hmm. Just make it very simple. That's very good.
One other thing, and this is kind of a hobby horse of mine, but modeling, if you're teaching grammar, model it. I hear so many times, and I used to do this, and I still fall up on it sometimes, but can versus may. Mm. When you teach that, modeling it is absolutely imperative. Mm. I was in a class, listening in on a class not too long ago, where the teacher was teaching, it was the lesson where they taught attacked versus attacking us. Mm-hmm. And the student was asking her, you know, why are we learning this? I've never heard anybody say attacked. Are there actually people that... And I wasn't the teacher, so I didn't say it, but I felt if she would have been my student, I would have said, yeah, there's occasionally people that say attacked, and there's also people that say can instead of may.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Very good. With nervousness, remember that it can help you channel your energy. It can pump you full of energy and help you to speak. Another tip on nervousness, before I did school programs, when I was teaching in Southern BC, I would go into McDonald's and buy a poutine. Now, I need to be from Canada to know what a poutine is, I guess, but it's delicious. It's French fries with gravy and cheese curds on top and served warm. Well, that's just a load of starch and protein. And when your stomach's just going like this, if when it's still level, you can load it up with some protein. It'll just sit in there and it'll hold you down the whole time. I found it to work quite well. And I was happy this morning to add eggs out there. I'm going to dish into these things because it'll help you. If you're just running on sugar and coffee, you're going to have a hard time restraining yourself. I hear the bell went and we need to close. A final illustration that ends with strength, I believe, as far as public speeches go, and also goes very well with the feelings a public speaker can have. General MacArthur is general during the Korean War, loved by the public. but disagreed with Truman on some important points and was not leading the U.S. Army as Truman wanted him to. So ultimately, Truman brought him home. And when he gave his closing speech before all the people, the public, these were his words. He says, "I'm closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plain at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye." Thank you.